Welcome to this Family and Community Strengthening Forum. I'm your host, Richard Urban. Come on up, Stace. And Stacey's our lovely co-host. So, okay. We're here at the beautiful Peace Kingdom Center in historic Harpers Ferry. We're high up on the Shenandoah Mountain. And so those who are here, welcome. And, you know, thank you also for those who are joining us online. We're grateful you could be here. And we're thankful for that. So today I'll be your first speaker, and I'll be also giving the premise for this forum today. So we'll get started. So the premise is, and this is something that, you know, I'm hoping or asked all the speakers to, you know, include at least in some aspect, to break the generational cycle of outside of wedlock birth, we need a revolution of abstinence-centered education. Parents should present the expectation of sexual abstinence before marriage to their children, regardless of whether or not they abstain themselves. They should think about what is best for their children's future and speak honestly about their own situation. School and community-based programs such as Urban Life Training can back up parents in making this revolution. In one generation, this can break the cycle of outside of wedlock births and all of the related personal and societal consequences. I'd like to welcome up Michael Marshall, and he'll be our next speaker. And Michael is the editor emeritus of UPI, and he can introduce himself more. So thank you.
Again, thank you, Richard. As he mentioned, I'm the editor emeritus of United Press International, which is a news service. Mostly online these days. I was there for about 7-8 years. And prior to that, I was the editor-in-chief of the World and I magazine, a monthly magazine which covered a wide range of topics. I'm very honored to be here today. And thank you to Richard for putting together this workshop. It's been going 3 days, three different segments, and today we're looking at the theme of strengthening families and communities, the idea of peaceful families and peaceful world, and the connection between the two. So, Richard presented a lot about the creation of abstinence-centered sex education. And as you saw from his presentation, this is not simply a matter of how young people behave sexually. It's also making them aware of their future goals and lives and the place that love and its sexual expression should have within that. So the purpose of abstinence-based sex education is ultimately that young people should become adults who marry and then have and raise children in a stable, loving two-parent family. And that's the goal, and that's what I'm going to be talking about today. So my thesis is that the family is the key to the physical, emotional, and spiritual well-being of individuals. And if we understood properly the significance and importance of family, it would also resolve much of the moral and social confusion that affects our society today. There's much focus in media and popular culture on a wide variety of lifestyles. And the one lifestyle that doesn't get a lot of attention and is given much coverage is the traditional family, stable two-parent families and the children that they raise. And this it's more than sad, it's something that's tragic, because the reality is there is a great wealth of research, sociological and psychological research, that shows the benefit of raising children in two-parent families. Yet this is widely ignored by mainstream media. And it's almost like something delusional and self-centered that simply does not want to face the facts of this information, which I'll get into as I go along, because it would interfere with different lifestyles where people are seeking different forms of pleasure that are for the moment and the present, and don't look to the future, as you have to do if you're parents in a family raising children and are serious about it. So an example of what I mean by this something delusional about this neglect of the prolific evidence of the benefit of two-parent families. Back in the 1960s, no-fault divorce was introduced. No-fault divorce meant that a couple could decide they didn't make each other happy anymore and would break up and seek happiness elsewhere. Prior to that, divorce could only happen for the three A's: abandonment, abuse, adultery. Those were the grounds for divorce. With no-fault divorce, you could decide, I've had enough of this relationship, I want out. At the time in the 60s, obviously the question was raised, what impact is this going to have on the children? And the answer from many psychologists, even though there weren't any studies that went over a long period of time, the answer was, children are resilient, so children will adapt. There won't be any harm and long-term consequences, which has proven simply untrue. Since the 60s, there have been plenty of what are called longitudinal studies. That is, studies that go over many years, even many decades, following the children of divorce. And what they have found is that there are long-term consequences that carry on into adulthood for the experience a child has of its parents breaking up, separating. One of the things that happens is, of course, the child feels responsible. Was it because of me? Was it because of me that my parents left? Which is a terrible thing to put upon a child. And what happens is that the emotional impact carries over into adulthood, and it affects the way in which young people, young adults who are the children of divorce, then form their own relationships. They find it not easy to trust. They are hesitant about marriage because what the example do they have? Look what happened to my parents. So how can I be sure that if I marry, the same won't happen to me? Having children, the attitude to children. Do I want to bring children into the world and then my husband or wife and I break up? And so these effects are well documented in psychological studies these days. But at the time, what was being said, that children are resilient, was basically telling the people who sought no-fault divorce what they wanted to hear, which is, you can act on your own selfish interest, and you don't have to worry about your kids because there'll be no really bad effects on them. So this is what I would call a false narrative, where the reality is ignored because it's inconvenient. And in this field of family, sexual relations, there are many, many false narratives sad to say. Let's look a little bit at the benefits of the two-parent families. I'm going to read a couple of quotes from an organization called the International Federation for Family Development. This is an NGO which is in special consultative status with the UN, with the Economic and Social Committee of the UN. So they have a considerable global standing. In one of their submissions, they said this: as the basic and essential building blocks of societies, families have a crucial role in social development. They bear the primary responsibility for the education and socialization of children, as well as instilling values of citizenship and belonging in the society. Now, to many of us, that would seem, well, isn't that obvious? And it should be obvious, but the reality is that there are many trends in society and in our culture that ignore that truth, act as if it isn't true. The IFFD lists some of the many benefits that come from stable two-parent families. And these are supported by multiple research studies. Stable families have a higher life expectancy, a lower risk of mental illness, alcoholism, and domestic violence. The children show lower infant mortality rate, lower risk of drug addiction, and lower incidence of engaging in criminal activities after puberty. Higher academic achievements and fewer unwanted teenage pregnancies. These are some of the established benefits of two-parent families. And they go on to say that evidence shows that the outcomes for both children and adults are not equal regardless of the family structure. So whether it's, you know, there's a big difference, as we'll see, between two-parent families and one-parent families. So let's take a look at some of the costs of ignoring the two-parent families. First of all, to put things in perspective, back in 1960, it's a long time ago now, 5% of births in America were births to unmarried mothers, to what used to be called out-of-wedlock births. Around 2010, that figure had risen to 41%, from 5% to 41% in 50 years. This is a major, vast social and cultural shift, and it's one where we have only really hardly begun to address and deal with the consequences. So what are some of the costs of that? Children health. Children of divorce are 50% more likely to develop health problems than kids in stable two-parent homes. That's not just emotional and mental problems, even physical problems. I mean, often physical problems are the result of emotional or mental stress. Even physical problems are higher for the children of single-parent families. Education. Children in single-parent homes or even blended homes. A blended home is where there's two parents, but one is a step-parent, usually a stepfather. Those children are less likely to graduate high school or complete college. Kids with stepfathers are more likely to be suspended or expelled from school, have problems with teachers, getting their homework done. They have lower grade point average. Let's look at the economic side, the economic difference. In 2009, the poverty rate in the US for single parent families was just over 37%. So 37% of single parent families were below the poverty line. For two parent families, that figure was 6.8%. 37% against 6.8%. Robert Rector, who's an expert on these issues, called marriage one of the greatest weapons against child poverty. And that's a simple truth. 25% of children under the age of 18, that's about 17.5 million children, are being raised with no father. I think these are figures from around 2010. 45% of those, that's nearly a half of those children are below the poverty line. Let's look at the rate of income. For single mothers, 2013, their median income was $26,000 a year. Median income means that that's the middle. Half of the group you're talking about is above that and half is below that. What was the median income at that time, 2013? for married couples and families with two parents, $84,000. $84,000, $26,000. So this is a vast difference, which people promoting different forms of family and so on do not want to talk about. But the reality is, I mean, actually the United States has one of the highest child poverty rates among developed nations. And this, the cause of this is not primarily economic conditions, it's cultural attitudes that make it okay to have single parent families. Now, a lot of people would say, well, family arrangements and whether you're married or choose to have children, not be married, these are private matters. It's all up to the individual's concern. This is simply not true, because these data that I've laid out have social consequences that affect the whole society and that the state has an interest in. Negative social behaviors. You get a higher level of negative social behaviors, crime, drug use, and so on, from the children of single parent families. That's a problem that should concern everybody. Even more so, the economic picture I've painted, with so many single parent families living in poverty, that they need to have welfare support. So taxes have to be paid to provide welfare for single parent families who, if they were married and had a stable family, would not need that support. So that is a broad social issue. It's not just a private matter. This disturbing situation has come about because of a significant change in values from what I would call a we culture to a me culture. And who suffers the most from this change? Exactly. Children are the ones who suffer the most from this change. The no fault divorce and the attitude to it is an example of that. So in a way, this may sound a little bit shocking, but I think there's truth in it. Our culture, our society practices its own rather peculiar form of child sacrifice. You know, you read about these ancient societies that made sacrifice of children to some god and so on. Today, we sacrifice the interests of children many times for the satisfaction of the present wants and desires of adults. If we look at the marriage equality movement, that's a big example of exactly that. Marriage equality was, you know, marriage should be about two people, doesn't matter what sex, different sex, same sex, but marriage equality is a civil right. And it's about two people who want to make some sort of commitment in their lives together. This is a radical change in the meaning of marriage. And is one, again, that has not been recognized, because the people who promoted the marriage equality movement are promoting it, didn't say, we want to change the meaning of marriage. They said, marriage is a civil right. Therefore, people of the same sex should have the same civil right as people of opposite sex. But that is not what marriage has been about traditionally. Marriage was a union of a man and a woman. Why? Not primarily for their mutual satisfaction, but to form a stable bond within which children would be conceived, born, and raised. And as we all know, among all all mammals, human beings have the longest period of time to growth. So if you have a child and you're a responsible person, or better still, a responsible couple, you are committed to make sacrifice to raise that child to adulthood. And not just any adulthood, but adulthood where they are people of character, responsibility, who can make something of their lives, and if a whole society is thinking that way, then you're actually raising a future generation who can lead the society after your generation, our generation, has passed away. That vision of marriage has been pushed aside. Marriage that was future oriented, raising the next generation, has become marriage that is focused on the present. The satisfaction of the desires now in the present of two individuals who want to get married. And what's the foundation of that marriage? We make each other happy. So what happens if and when that stops? We don't make each other happy anymore. The marriage is gone, is dissolved. And, you know, I don't want to put this all on the marriage equality movement, because the roots, the roots of this trend started back with the no-fault divorce, which was also about, I'm not happy in this relationship. I want to be able to pursue some other path. And so my partner, my children, if I have children, they are going to be second to my own desires. So what's neglected in all of this? Rights. I like to think about children's rights. There are many claims of rights today. Personally, I think if you're a citizen of the country, you have rights. And all citizens should have equal rights, and you don't have special rights. There's no need for special rights for one group or another group, and so on. But if we're talking in those sort of terms, the group that is most needs some sort of rights and is most neglected is children. As we mentioned, there's little emphasis on the emotional impact on children of unstable marriages. But unstable marriages, or being raised by a single parent, it affects a child's sense of their fulfilled self, and in the future, their ability to contribute to society. The child, if you think about it, a child is the most vulnerable person in society. And nobody consulted us and said, do you want to be born? We're born, right? We had no say in it. Here we are. Nobody consulted us about, okay, you're born, but do you want to be born to these parents? No, we have no, the children have no choice in that. So given you have no choice and you come into this world, don't you think that the child has a right and expectation to have come into the world with two parents who have conceived that child and are committed to raise that child, educate it, sustain it, and most of all, love that child? That's the basis of what a child should be able to expect. And so much of what is happening simply ignores that. And this is a serious issue and serious problem going forward, because societies that lose their vision, I think there's a saying in the Bible, in the book of Proverbs, I believe, where there is no vision, the people perish. So if we have no vision for the future and are only living for present satisfaction, and this is not just about, you know, family relationships, having children, sexual relationships. I mean, the whole of our commercial culture and advertising is about satisfying your desire now or as quickly as possible. So a society who raises people who don't think of the future, maybe not their own future, certainly not the future of the society as a whole, doesn't have a future. It's going to dissolve and disintegrate. So I think that the revival of family addresses many real social and cultural issues. There are many practical reasons, you know, the outcomes that the data has shown for health, economic benefits, doing well in school, having a stable character, not getting into trouble with the law. These are things that should be widely known in society, and people in society of any frame of thought to say, this is good for our society. But to do that is going to take a big cultural change. And if you look at cultural changes through history, the most significant cultural changes have often been underpinned and driven by a spiritual and moral reawakening. You know, you had in American history, the Great Awakenings. In English history, I'm originally from England. William Wilberforce is well known for his 20-year campaign as a member of parliament to bring an end to the slave trade, then followed up with another 20-year campaign to end slavery in the West Indian islands that were British colonies at the time. His inspiration was his Christian faith. He was inspired by the movement of John Wesley and took seriously the idea that we are made, human beings are made in the image of God. And because of that, how can one human being own another human being as property? So that spiritual revolution that started with Wesley found a seed in Wilberforce and his supporters to turn it not just into faith and belief, but into practical action to bring major change in society. So I think as regards the family, we need that sort of vision at this time to rectify the bad consequences that come from a poor understanding of human nature and human values. So Genesis 1:27 says, God made man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. So that suggests that the image of God is not just in individuals, but the image of God is more fully present in, at least in God's ideal and hope, in a man and a woman who are joined together in a loving relationship that puts God at the center. Now, imagine that sort of relationship where a couple, God can express himself through a couple, and then through that couple, they give birth to children. In a sense, that those children would be sons and daughters of God in a very real sense, to the extent that God is present in their parents. And what then would happen in a family that is raised and exists like that? Within a family, the child would grow learning the different aspects of love. So as a child, your love is passive. You receive love from your parents. If a child is not loved by its parents, it's going to have difficulties in later life. So that's a child's love. You receive love from your parents and all the aunts and uncles who say, you know, goo, 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 isn't he cute, isn't she? As you grow, you learn to interact with your siblings. And if you don't have siblings, maybe with cousins. But you interact with other kids around your age, maybe some a little older. And as you get older, some a little younger. And out of that, you learn that you are not actually the center of the universe, even though your parents, while you were small, made you the center of certainly their universe, and rightly. But you learn, okay, I'm not the center of the universe. I have to deal with other people and learn how to have giving and receiving with them to get on together with other people. As you grow to maturity, you begin to look for a partner of the opposite sex. And ultimately, the natural course is you find such a partner and you marry. And then together you experience a third type of love. We've had the child's passive love, the sibling love, and then the most intimate form of mutual love, that between a husband and a wife. Out of that love comes new life, the next generation of children. And those children, the couple then learn what it is to love as a parent, which takes a lot of sacrifice, sometimes frustration. But through that, couple learn, aha, now I understand my parents much better, because I realize what they went through with me. So it's a way in which that thread of love and understanding is passed down through the generations. And even more so, through that creation of new life through love, as a couple has a child, they are learning to share the experience that God must have had when out of his love, he created the first human beings. So we too have that blessing that out of love, we can create new life and then a generation for the future. And then in raising that child, you're preparing a person of character, a responsibility, who can then be responsible for their family and maybe beyond to their community. The values that are learned within the family are then the values that a child that's grown to adulthood then expresses in the wider society. And that is a vision of what I would call a God-centered family. The family becomes the school of love and the training ground of character. Now, this vision, yesterday Richard gave a presentation, the exposition of the divine principle, and this vision of the family is absolutely central to the divine principle, which is the revelation and inspiration of the late Reverend Sun Myung Moon. Reverend Moon in his life started many projects and initiatives, but at the center of everything was his vision for creating ideal families who could live together with God, and living with God then could create God's kingdom of original love on this earth. So he launched a pure love movement for young people before marriage, a marriage blessing movement where people who were getting married or who were already married could rededicate themselves to this vision of marriage and family centered on God. The work that Richard's been doing with the abstinence training and so on is promoting this idea of a pure love movement, and that young people who follow that path then become, not only they do better in school, they don't get into trouble with the law, they earn more money, but they become people of more full and rounded character, capable of loving others. Let me conclude here by a couple of quotes. One is from the late Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, who was the chief rabbi of the United Kingdom and the Commonwealth, who said some wonderful things about the importance of families. The family, man, woman, and child, is not one lifestyle choice among many. It is the best means we have yet discovered for nurturing future generations and enabling children to grow in a matrix of stability and love. It is where we learn the delicate choreography of relationships and how to handle the inevitable conflicts within any human group. It is where we first take the risk of giving and receiving love. It is where one generation passes on its values to the next, ensuring the continuity of a civilization. Now, I don't think you can get a better expression of the value and the multiple facets of family than that. But let me, final quote. This one is from Reverend Moon, talking about what he saw would unfold in the 21st century. And he said that in the course of the 20th century, as well as a couple of other things he mentioned, humanity will gradually come to realize the divine value and the social significance of the family as the basic school of true love. This realization will arise out of the painful experiences of family breakdown and the abnormal transformation of the family throughout the world during recent decades. So that's the seed of hope, that out of the current confusion and mixture of values and self-centered values getting prominence in our society, that yet there is a seed for a true understanding of family and its benefits and blessings able to come forth. So I hope that all of you listening here and everybody who sees this video in the future, sees this course here, will take that to heart and become among the growing number of people who want to promote this vision of the family and make it a reality. Thank you very much. Just hand over to Richard here.
Hey, thank you, Michael. Wow, that's beautiful and absolutely essential, as we were saying, you know, to really, well, to help our society. That's the only way, like the premise says. So that was exactly in line with the premise. We need, you know, revolution of absence-centered education, because we've got to start to break that cycle somewhere. So I think that's a very, you know, important thing. Do we have a question for Michael or myself about what we've shared so far?
I was wondering, what's the best website to get the historical, like, information and studies that he was drawing from?
Okay, let's have Michael can come up and share that.
Yeah, there's quite a few. The one that I mentioned is the International Federation for Family Development. There's also, if you just Google and Family Research. This is the Family Research Council. The Heritage Foundation has a section that looks at family and society. Maybe after this is done, I can get together with Richard and maybe make a little list of other organizations, and you can post it. Yeah, yeah. I think that's. But those are a couple to get you started with.
So thank you again, Michael. Okay.
So thank you, Mr. Marshall.